Welcome to Growing Up in America on KPFT Houston Pacifica Radio with our host from Children at Risk, noted policy expert Mandy Kimball, and Chief Executive Officer Dr. Katie McConnell. What do we have on tap today, Mandy and Katie?
Hello, hello. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday, Houston. Happy Monday, Mandy.
Yay!
Mandy.
Oh, it's Mandy.
Oh. How about that?
It's great to have you here
Thank
again.
Thank you so much, and welcome back. Of the last few weeks, I know you've been traveling, vacationing, last minute, quick vacation with the kids before they got back to school.
It's true.
Working some too.
We are back in the routine. Everyone can do the happy dance. School has started.
No one can quite do the happy dance like Mandy Kimball can, Houston, just so you know. But the boys did good getting back in the groove, getting back in the swing of things.
It's working.
All right.
That's right. Structure, there's a lot
it's
to be said.
So good.
Especially at a young age.
Right.
Structure is nice, as you know. You're doing okay?
I'm great. This is my third week being here.
We're going to call it the Katie McConnell Show
soon. I think you probably should.
Now, Dr. Bob is gone this week.
Yes.
In Maine, visiting his fam.
That's right. His annual summer vacation up there. So.
See, he's lucky and smart. He goes once school has started.
That's right. And to a location that's a little bit cooler.
That's right.
The true.
How about that? But we're going to have a fantastic show today. Kick us off, Katie. What do we have going on?
Absolutely. Great show today. So we're going to start off with one of our favorite people from Children at Risk, the co-director of the Center for Social Measurement and Evaluation, Dr. David McClendon. And he's going to be talking about the significance of the number 48.
48. What could it mean? Stay tuned and find out. And after Date Ahead, we will have Katie Vittoria from the Hay Center, and she's going to be talking about their work with children and foster care. I'm excited. The Hay Center is fantastic.
She's doing such great work. So much to learn from Katie. And then we will have another very interesting voice to hear today, Miriam Camaro from RACES, and she will be talking about their work in the detention centers and the lasting psychological effects on children. We've been talking about this a lot lately with all the news on the border and everything. So she's doing some hands-on work right now. She'll be able
give
to
us
provide
an update.
A good perspective. Yeah.
Good deal. And today on our social conscience scale, we want you to call in and share your opinion in our thumbs up or thumbs down segment. And today we're talking about 4-day school weeks. And the news recently, a school district in Colorado announced that they will be transitioning to a 4-day school week by not having classes on Monday. No one will be able to talk about it's Monday.
Yes, I've got a case of the Mondays.
Oh, no. No, this is really interesting. And I mean, I know that Colorado is doing it, but when you look at research and articles that are coming out, I think this is getting more and more attention.
It is.
I'll be curious. Give us your opinion. Is it a good thing or bad?
I'll be real curious to see what people here think. I know there's so many different schedules that we don't really even consider here in Houston or across the state of Texas, really.
That's
so
right.
Good perspective. And then our final guest today will be a great show, a great friend of the show, Ann Sung, who is with Project Grad and, as we know, a trustee for the HISD Board of Education. And she's going to be talking to us just about some back-to-school tips in general.
There we go. Sounds like a fantastic show. Welcome to Growing Up in America on KPFT Houston's Pacifica Radio, a discussion on our children, public policy, politics, and our future, and how do we as a nation do when it comes to taking care of all of our kids. Today we have Dr. Katie McConnell.
Happy to be co-hosting again.
Yay!
With you this time, Mandy.
Great for you to be here. Thank you so much.
And we're happy to have you back, too. I know your voice is one that's missed over the airways when you're gone, so.
You're so kind.
So kind.
All right. So let's do this. Date Ahead. And today we have David McClendon, co-director for the Center for Social Measurement Evaluation for Children at Risk. How are you doing today, David?
I'm doing great. How about y'all?
Wonderful. Happy Monday.
You too.
So what's the number? What do you have for us?
So the number is 48%.
48%.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Perhaps 48%, the number of children in the greater Houston area that have already started back to school.
That That is not the number. That might be true. I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, it was worth a shot.
Nice try.
Yeah, I thought I would come up with something. It's back to school themed.
There we go. What is
it?
Yeah.
Well, it's close. So 48% is the percentage of school districts, high poverty school districts, that received an A or a B rating from TEA, the state's new accountability rating system last week.
Well, you're just throwing it out there, aren't you, Dr. McClendon? So TEA released the school districts with grades, which this is pretty controversial.
It is very
Children at Risk is very familiar with, because we have a reporting and rankings that go out. And a couple of years ago, the legislature decided that the state was going to start doing it. And there are a lot of people that are worried about this, David.
Right. So, I think one of the worries is that, we know there's a strong link between income and student test scores. So, in general, affluent students tend to do much better than low-income students for a whole lot of reasons. As far as student prep, more affluent parents can do more resources, be more involved in their kids' education. But also, things like access to early childhood education and pre-K that sort of shape those things as well, in addition to just sort of the challenges that are associated with poverty. So a lot of people are worried that these new grades really just penalize low-income schools for being low-income and don't reflect the amount of work that schools do to raise low-income students' test scores over time.
But if I look at 48% of our high poverty schools, that sends the message that almost half of our high poverty schools, their kids are doing really well. Their kids are doing an above average performance. Is that not an appropriate interpretation there?
Right. No. So that's one of the sort of surprising findings to come out. I think when the ratings first came out, one of the things people focused on was the fact that there are basically no affluent districts that do poorly on the ratings. So if you look at those that have, less 25% low-income students, basically all those districts get an A or a B. And so mostly, the C's, D's, and F's are for higher poverty districts. But, when you look at that, the really high poverty districts, there's a lot doing really well in these new ratings, suggesting, that the state's ratings are taking into account things like student growth, whether they're closing the socioeconomic and race ethnic gaps in the district.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things we've been focusing on for a long time, and you both know this, is that, figuring out what are the best practices at these high poverty, high performing schools and how can they be replicated across the state.
Well, and I think that is extremely important, because we can talk about ratings or rankings or whatnot, and let's get the information out there. Let's make sure that parents and community stakeholders know how schools are doing as a whole in regards to student performance. Okay, so you have that information out there.
Just that blanket information.
But
right.
we can't allow the conversation to stop. So what do we do with that information? And so, yes, 48%. Is too low for low-income or high-poverty school districts. We need more. However, that also
right.
shows that there are a lot of people or a lot of school districts that are getting those A's and B's. They've figured it out. And how can we expand those efforts, replicate those efforts, learn from those efforts to empower others? It's just really important. I don't know.
Exactly.
I mean, Katie, you used to be a principal.
That's how right.
Talk to us, because I'm sure I will tell you as a parent, in Fort Bend, right, there are school districts that are coming out saying, we do not agree with this. This
That's
is
right.
not how we should be graded. And this information, it's not necessarily a positive message that's being sent out to parents. So thus then parents are like, why are we doing this? Is this bad?
Can That's right. That well, line? And I think, when this passed a couple of sessions ago, I had the opportunity to testify at that point in time and talk about contention
mm-hmm.
in a conference room there. People are afraid, I think a lot of people are afraid that it doesn't shed light on all that schools are really doing, in particular, as David has pointed out, these high poverty schools.
Right?
Absolutely
yeah.
true. But the bottom line is, to your point, Mandy, we have to have kind of a baseline to know where our schools are so we know we can continue to improve, to make sure that every kid is getting what they need, especially right now when we have a school finance system. Sorry, I can bring any conversation back to school finance. But when we're trying to figure out the best solution that's going to meet the needs of all of our students statewide, to know where different schools are performing and what level they're able to perform, is there a correlation with funding? Do we need to give more to different places? This is just one of the many kind of pieces of mm-hmm. the puzzle. I think that hopefully, to your point, there are some best practices in place that with proper funding we'll be able to scale so all of our kids have the opportunity to be successful
right.
and get that free appropriate public education that we're all entitled to.
There you go.
Sorry, I just got on my high horse. I didn't mean to. David, Dr.
Good.
McClendon, I blame you.
Yeah, no, but thank you, David, for highlighting something that not everyone knows on when a lot of people are thinking that schools are being penalized. You're
That's
framing
right.
it in a way that, hey, there's nearly a half of the high poverty school districts are doing a great job. And what can we pull from it? So thank you very much, David.
You're welcome.
Take
Have
care.
All righty.
Thanks, David.
So this conversation isn't going to end,
nope.
right? And so I know that there are a lot of school districts in the greater Houston area and really even across from Texas who have gotten a waiver.
That's right.
Also, who didn't get a grade this year because of Hurricane Harvey, and understanding that situation.
That's
and so
right.
to be continued.
Well, yeah, absolutely, to be continued. And a lot of those that were opposed to it previously remain opposed to it, with some light continuing to be shed because many people feel like the rules have changed midway through the game. And so we're not sure exactly where TEA is going to take this or what they're going to do with it. So I think those next steps, now that they've released these ratings, the next steps are what's going to prove to be really important. And if we can continue to encourage the growth in our education system, or if it really is going to be even more perceived like a penalty.
Yeah, no. And I think as far as advocates and parents, it's not shaking the finger saying, what
Absolutely
are you doing wrong?
Not.
But how can we better support you? Which means really supporting our kids so that every child can be successful. Interesting. And there will be a lot more conversations
lot
around
more to,
this.
We're just,
forward.
What, 5 days into the release of these. So.
All right. So up next, we have Katie Vittoria, who is a volunteer program specialist with the Hay Center. The Hay Center is such a fabulous resource in our community. How are you doing today, Katie?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Great. Thanks for being here.
Thank
so for
you for
those,
the invite.
Yes. For those who are not familiar with the Hay Center, can you talk a little bit about your mission?
So the Hay Center, also known as the Houston Alumni and Youth Center, is a public-private partnership where our focus is really on empowering current and former foster youth to become successful adults. So we do that through training and mentorship, focusing on education, employment, and personal achievement.
Yeah, and such a wonderful program. You know, when we talk about foster care, which I tell you, there's been quite a bit of focus on foster care over the past couple of years, mm-hmm. Particularly last session. And, you know, what can we do? And there was a court ruling saying, hey, we need to do more for these vulnerable youth. The system is broken. And so there were improvements there. But the Hay Center, although you are supporting the foster care, the children who are in foster care at that point, but it's the transitioning piece.
That's right.
Right?
You hear so often about the kids that age out of foster care.
Well, that who are in, but what about the kids who age out?
Right.
So at 18, just like when you graduate high school, you're kind of graduating out of or aging out of the foster care system. But the reality is that you need so much more support, right?
Right. So one of the great things about our agency is that, yes, we do provide services for those youth that are in care, but we work with them until the age of 26. So they can continue to come and receive different services, after care transitional services that can help them with their transition, because you're absolutely right. At 18, they're expected to know exactly what they're going to do, how they're going to do it, where they're going to go, and many times, just like any here, they have no idea what the next step is. They've been in a system where everything has been taken care of for them. They've been told what time to get up, go to school, doctor's appointments they're taken to, they're scheduled for them. So at 18, when you're expected to know all of that on your own, it's no wonder that they are lost in
like any 18, 19-year-old would be, honestly.
Right, like right. Anyone would. And unlike their typical peer in high school, they do not have the support when they leave. They cannot call a family member or friend to say, hey, I'm struggling in this area. Can I come back home until I figure out how college is going to work for
or
me?
Or mom and dad.
Right.
I need some money.
Mm-hmm.
Or
exactly.
I miss you. Can I come home for a little bit?
Or even during the holidays, and sometimes we don't think about when schools are closed for the session and they're off for spring break or for the holidays, they have nowhere to return to because they've often been at different foster homes or residential treatment centers. And when there's no one to welcome them back to say, yeah, you can stay here while you're on break.
So how many children are we talking about in the Harris County or Greater Houston area?
So on average every year, there's about 200 young adults, 18, that will age out of foster care. Some may choose to stay in what's called extended foster care, where they're allowed to stay in a paid placement by the state until the age of 21. But many times at that 18th birthday, our youth want to leave. They want to leave the system. They want to have an opportunity to be on their own. So on average, we see about 200. Last year, it was 181 of the 17,000 that were in care and exited throughout the state.
That's wrong.
That is, and I'm just thinking, I'm sitting here having, like, flashbacks to 18.
Mm-hmm. Of you course, wanted out as well.
Yes! I absolutely, yeah. And I knew all there was to know, and then some.
Mm-hmm.
You could
so
have just
thought.
Asked me, I would have told, you didn't even have to ask, I would have told you.
Yeah.
But, you know, I can see where, you know, these kids are making the choice to, you know, go out and explore and try and find their independence. But what an amazing resource that if they see they still have needs, that you can absolutely provide some of the support for them.
So we're talking about support. What kind of services and support are provided through this program?
So through the Hays Center, we operate the public side of our organization. We operate the Preparation for Adult Living, also known as PAL, state contract. So we assist our youth with those aftercare benefits that they receive because they did leave the system. There are certain benefits, aftercare room and board benefits that they're available to access. So we assist in providing those for them. But also on our private side, we do a lot of different programs that include our mentorship program, our transition coaching program that helps match those youth with a volunteer who can help them through this transitional period and offer them that support that's outside of the foster care system and the people that they are usually associated with on their cases. We also provide rental assistance. We have a new housing program that can help some of them who've decided, you know what, I am ready to leave care, but there's very limited housing options out there for an 18-year-old who has never had any type of rental assistance. Mm-hmm. They don't have a credit history. No parent to co-sign. They don't make three times the rent, which is often mm-hmm. required for a brand new person getting a lease. So we started our Bridge Housing Program in December of last year, and we currently have 17 youth in our program. We provide a rent-free apartment for them. They actually signed a lease with the apartment complex, but we guarantee that rent for a year, giving them that opportunity to have some independence, learn how to live on your own, but also have the safety net of having a case manager on staff who can still help them learn to develop those life skills, have more intensive case management where somebody's kind of keeping on track, saying, hey, are you going to school? Are you working? How can we help you get that job? How can we get you going in, you know, your schooling? So that's our Bridge Housing program that just started, and so far going very well. We hope to at least have at least 25 youth housed by the end of our pilot year.
Wow, that's great. Congratulations on that. That's a huge accomplishment. And I'm sure with the program, trying to manage all the program, work out the kinks, I'm sure it's been a busy year. But I know those 17 kids that are there right now are in a good position. Mm-hmm. You've really helped them. You also mentioned some of the mentoring programs that you have that come as part of their, I guess, part of their case management. Can you talk a little bit about those programs?
So our mentoring program has been now in existence for about 4 years. And like all of the programming here at the Hay Center, it's really youth-focused. So they let us know what it is they need. And we try to develop a program for that. And if we can't, we are a referral partner. So we make sure that we can put them in contact with another agency that is providing the services that they need. But the transition coaching program came about because youth were coming in, talking to the director, saying, you know, I really wish I had someone who could have helped me along the way, who could have kind of given me that advice that I needed. And so through that, we developed this program where, again, our transition coaches, our volunteers, are just such a vital resource to us. They are from all demographics, all different educational backgrounds, all different business and career backgrounds, and they simply go in and provide this one-on-one relationship to this youth who many times hasn't had that opportunity to have a person in their life solely focus on them and what their needs are, what their goals are, and trying to get them there. So our coaches really fill in as that friend and give the youth an opportunity to learn what it's like to be in a positive friendship, positive relationship where somebody is just there teaching them, one, accountability, because a lot of times our youth don't have that opportunity to learn accountability in a system like the foster care system. Everyone is accountable to them to make sure that they're safe and getting everything they need, but there's not really a time for them to show that they can be accountable as well. So that volunteer steps in, helps them. We have volunteers who have moved their youth into college for the first time, taking them on college tours because that's the first time the youth will have that opportunity.
Are there any needs for the center? I think of last session when there was a lot of focus on, you know, revamping the foster care system. Did y'all have any conversations? Did the legislative session help with the funding, with funding or additional supports, or is there a need still moving forward?
So I think there's always a need with this particular group. There's just so many aspects of their life that they need that assistance with. And again, for us, the number one need is housing, because that's really what is required for them to be able to focus on those other goals.
Sure.
If you don't know where you're going to live and you don't have a safe place to stay, it's difficult to think about what college you're going to go to or, you know, what job you're going to be able to get. And that is what we find most often, even our young adults and youth who may have been diagnosed with a mental health issue, they are not really able to focus on their own mental health needs because they're needing their first
basic needs
is to find
be able
to find that housing for them. So that's the number one thing that we see that our kids need the most.
There's and, a lot oh go ahead.
No. That's why we developed that program and hope to grow the transition coaching program, and we work so closely with other transitional living programs so that our youth are able to find somewhere where they're be able to have a safe place to stay.
Sure. So for the last 30 seconds, their listeners, is there any way that the community can support the Hay Center and how so?
So we have a lot of different opportunities to support. We, of course, have our website, haycenter.org, where they can go on and see the different volunteer opportunities, including working with the youth in the Bridge Housing Office and the different ways in which they can donate towards the different programs that we have, including our education programs, our college tours, our summer jobs program, where we place youth at different job locations, right. And we're always looking for placements. It's like an internship for the employer, and the Hay Center pays the youth their salary.
Well, that is great. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today and for all of the work that you're doing to help the kids in the Houston area. Thank you so much. And again, for any of our listeners, if you want to find out more about the Hay Center or ways that you can help support the Hay Center, that's Hayes. You can look them up at haycenter.org.
That's great. Thank you so much, Katie. Take
no
care.
No problem. Thank you.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
It's always so great to hear what so many people, all the work our community is doing.
It's true. I just think that this is a sensitive topic because people, yes, think about children in foster care, but they do age out. And I don't know. I personally don't know if people think about the 18 and older kids enough, and that if we are as compassionate as we should be with them. I mean, right. 18 through 25, I mean, no one's got their head on straight.
No.
And so, especially a vulnerable population like
that's
that,
right.
I think there's more to do in regards to supporting their efforts.
But we're lucky to have the Hay Center here in town. And again, we encourage anyone that wants to learn more to look them up.
If you look around, the whole world's
how about this intro music?
Now.
On the phone, we have Miriam Camaro. Are you there, Miriam?
Hi.
Hi, how are you? That was quite an intro song. Did you pick that out yourself?
I did not. I wish I could take that credit.
It was very exciting. Well, thanks so much for taking the time to join us this afternoon. We have been taking a little bit of time each week for the last, probably month or so, to really continue to address what's going on with so many of our kids, with the family separation situation on the border, especially with so many kids that were relocated to Houston. So we're happy to talk to you today and get your perspective on some of the things that are going on.
Absolutely.
So I know last week we talked a little bit about the fact that almost 3 weeks after the deadline from the federal government for all of the families to be reunited, we were still facing many families that were separated. Can you update us on the status of that at this point in time?
Absolutely. And I think that before we touch on this, we should talk about something called the Flores Settlement. And that settlement was done in the last couple of years. And that settlement says that a minor should not be held within ICE without unnecessary delay. An unnecessary delay has been defined to approximately 20 days from the day in which they arrived to the custody of immigration authorities. So as you can see, once now we've talked about 3 weeks past deadline, and we're even going as far back as trying to see it being from middle June to end of June when the zero tolerance policy was enacted, how much 20 days has passed beyond this and how they are in violation of this settlement. So it's been an unprecedented set of tasks that we've had to just really get creative and really try to step up and try to empower and really help out these families once they're still being detained throughout it.
Well, and I think that's so key, right? Still. We are still facing this issue. This has not been, quote unquote, fixed yet.
Well, situations at the detention centers have gotten extreme. And I'm saying this because last Wednesday on the 15th of August, approximately 60 armed ICE officers and supporting authorities came rushing into the detention centers to essentially confiscate 16 men who were then again separated from their child and taken to Pearsall because they were, quote-unquote, causing a disturbance. But in fact, what they were doing is they were trying to be in compliant with what they were being asked to do, not taking their child to the schooling center or a hunger strike. And they're doing this for the sake of having a nonviolent protest for all of them to be released and be given some sort of legal relief as far as just release.
So this situation you're talking about last week, just so I'm clear, these were families that had previously been separated, had been reunited and then were separated again because of a lack, perceived lack of compliance?
Correct. So what has been, so this happened at the Carnes Residential Center, and that is, in other words, Family Detention Center. Typically, that detention center has been women and children for the past several years. Now it is fathers reunited with their children at this facility. And so what a group of them had been doing is essentially get together to form a nonviolent protest to really call to attention that they should be released. And that was just their method of what they were going to try to do.
So what is the problem in regards to not letting these people go or reunification? Is it partly because they're just backlogged and there's no capacity, or is there still a political fight behind the scenes or within the system?
It seems like it's obviously a little bit of both. I think one of the biggest problems that we have been foreseeing is that these parents and children are both undergoing credible fear interviews. When someone gets to the border and has expressed a fear to go back to their country, they have to have a credible fear interview. And during this interview, dad is essentially getting a negative as a result of this. In other words, not saying that they have an immigration officer has deemed him not credible enough to have enough fear to return to his country. Meanwhile, child who is being interviewed individually is coming out positive and saying, yes, he does have enough fear to not go back to his country. Hmm. So the problem then is, well, does dad get deported and child stays by himself here in the U.S. to fight his case? Or do they both get grouped together and child voluntarily gets deported with father because he can't be here by himself?
Which is what usually happens, unfortunately. Is that accurate?
Unfortunately. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And it's incredibly sad to see what's going on in there. I think one of the most touching and really sad part of what I saw at the detention centers is just hearing fathers ask their children to forgive them. And I think that's just so sad because it is outside of their control. And yet, they're trying to ask some sort of forgiveness for their children. And, I mean, just take a moment to just think about that for a second.
I was going to say, to process the psychological impacts that that's going to have, long-term impact that that's going to have on a child. We've had the opportunity, again, over the course of the summer, to really talk about this as much as possible and hear from different experts. And it always comes back to, what is the impact on the child?
Miriam, if you had to predict, what's the next month or two going to look like moving forward around this? Do you feel that it's getting the attention that it needs, that there's progress, although it's too small, or do you just think it's stale and we haven't figured it out yet?
I think there's always, there's extremely a huge amount of room for progress. But what I will say is I do think that there might be faster expedited removal proceedings happening. There might be an maybe more limited viable classes for asylum claims, as we saw with In Matter of AB with domestic violence restriction. I think I want to try to predict what's going to happen, but the moment we try to predict something, it just kind of ends up going.
I understand. Yep. And you don't want to jinx it either. I get it.
Yeah.
Mandy has that power. The rest of us just don't want to be wrong.
Right. No, that's hard. So for listeners, you know, that are concerned and they feel helpless, I mean, is there anything that people can do to help these families or kids right now?
So currently here in Houston, we are in the works to try to get mental health professionals who are licensed in the state of Texas to try to get some sort of training specifically to try to maybe have a pro bono mental health evaluation for those who are detained. And what this can do is during the credible fear interview, as I was saying, how parents are getting negatives out of it, remember saying that they don't have enough fear to it. What the mental health evaluation can do is try to show, well, you know, trauma affects memory, or there might be a cultural barrier as to why this specific parent didn't fully disclose all of his trauma or the whole story as to why he is scared to go back. So that's something that would be in the works, and stay tuned to the Houston Immigration Legal Service Collaborative for that. And then also just sign up, keep on to see at DiocesTexas.org for any volunteer opportunities. Now, I do always caution everybody, families are just settling and getting back to where, but they are now finally getting into our communities, namely Houston or California, all over the country. And most of the problems are where we will need volunteers are going to be not now, but later. So stick with us and just sign up for one of our volunteer opportunities, and we'll try to get you connected as soon as possible with a family who is in need in your own community. Unfortunately, I wish it was something more along the lines of between 9 to 5 on every first Wednesday of the month come out. Unfortunately, it's always a case-by-case basis, and we're really trying to be the most beneficial to our clients.
Well, thank you for everything that you guys are doing. Again, that website is, tell us one more time if we want to check on the volunteer opportunities.
Absolutely. So it's RaicesTexas.org, RAICES. And if you are a mental health professional who is willing to do pro bono mental health evaluations, please send us an email with the subject line mental health evaluations at Canopy, that's C-A-N-O-P-Y, at RaicesTexas, at RAICESTexas.org.
Thank you, Miriam. Thank you so much.
Thank you for all that you're doing, and we look forward to continued progress.
Yeah, absolutely. I hope so, too.
All right. Take care. Talk to you soon. All righty. Bye-bye.
Credible fear. I hear those words. It just makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up.
I know.
So it's a good thing we're transitioning to thumbs up, thumbs down, so we can debate something completely different, and it will give my nerves a chance to settle down a little bit, I hope.
All right. It's time for listeners to call in and give us your opinion. Thumbs up, thumbs down. Schools having a four-day week.
Before we get into it, for those that are eager to call in, we have your opinions one way or the other. Feel free to give us a call at 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-KPFT.
What are people thinking about four-day school weeks?
I'll be curious to hear. I'm actually curious as to your perspective. Uh-huh. As a mom with two kids, uh-huh, how would you feel if you had...
Okay, so that's a little bit different.
Okay, tell me why that's a little bit different.
Because as I have
Mandy
met...
Mandy just sat up real tall in
her
seat,
I have met with
guys.
Several superintendents, and they will be the first person to tell you, because the argument is like, I'm a working mom. What am I supposed to do with my child that next day?
That's what I was fishing for right there.
And the response is the education system is not child care. It's a public education system that's set up to do one thing, right? And so I remember like Hurricane Harvey, they're like, open up the schools. A lot of people were, we need to get them back to a routine, which was true.
Absolutely.
But some people are like, but we don't have any staff. And so I'm not just opening the doors to open the doors. Right. So I don't think it can be solely on, well, what do you do with the kid the next day? Right. So there have been a lot of, conversations. And I think what's really important is quality time on task. And so
just like I can bring anything back to school finance, I feel like you can bring everything back to quality time on task.
So is the quality time on task for 4 days, does that help them have 3 days for more enrichment, independent learning? I don't know. Is that what it's about? I mean, I think some students would have more opportunities than other if that was the situation.
And it would continue to separate our very obvious achievement gap.
Or is it about... And on Fridays, that's when teachers get together to better plan and collaborate and do the training so that we have a better, well-trained staff and teachers so that when they're in the classroom, it's on point.
I feel like that's something that teachers can never have enough of that.
That's
time.
Interesting.
It
right?
is very
And then
interesting.
As far as kids, is it we know that the, what is it, drill and kill? Kill and drill? Mm-hmm. Drill and kill? Is it drill and kill?
Drill and kill.
Yeah. That, I mean, does 4 days versus 5 days make a difference for them? I'm not quite sure. I know that there are a lot of things that are coming out. I can speak for, you know, for Fort Bend that, no, we have 5 days. However, once a month, there's a Friday that the kids aren't in school for that professional development and training or organization or whatever. And there's a lot of people who aren't happy with that. They're like, man, I've got to find something to do with my kid on this Friday.
Child
and
care.
I get it. But does that mean that the education that they receive is going to be better? Then it's something to consider.
And I do. You talk about meaningful time on task or quality time on task, right? And I think about if we're looking at extending the school year, perhaps to ensure that the kids are still getting.
Oh, well, that's a good point. I don't think we should cut the hours. I didn't articulate that.
No, you didn't.
No. So then I would assume that it would be a longer school year, which then there wouldn't be the summer slide.
Right.
Right.
Because I would hope that. Now, my one concern when I was, you know, doing a little bit of prep around this was I get the positive financial impact, right? Potentially you're saving money on bus routes and, you know, all of those things, your utilities and your school buildings, all those things. But is it absolutely what's best for kids, especially if we're looking at extending the school day? And I can tell you, having worked on
school year
or not even so much the school year,
the school
I think
day.
It's fine. But when I think about the school day, I think that's the first step a lot of people make. Kids are tired, especially we're looking at elementary kids. It is not developmentally appropriate for a kid to be expected to be on task for 10 hours a day. Mm-hmm. I am grown, very grown, actually, and it is hard. We change our modifier hours in the summer, and to work that long of a day, it's exhausting and a little bit counterproductive, I think.
We have callers. There we go. I can't see the names. Okay.
We're having some technical difficulties in studio.
First person is Johnny. How are you, Johnny?
So far, so good. Sometimes they say less is more.
Uh-huh.
I agree with that. I think we should have a four-day work week for school kids from fifth grade on up, but also a four-day work week for their parents, a 30 to 34-hour work week over 4 days, but at full-time pay, starting with Walmart. It's good enough for Germany. It's good enough for us.
I like that. And Johnny, if you don't mind, I'm just curious as to your line. I think you said fifth grade and up for those hours. What are your thoughts on the younger kids?
By the time you get to fifth grade and they start giving you these this relief, you appreciate it more and your performance will increase.
There you go.
I think that's a great thing
for working class parents.
All right. Thank you, Johnny.
Make America great for the first time.
Thanks, Johnny.
And then the next person, Wayne, how are you doing today?
Hey, how you doing?
Wonderful. Thumbs up or thumbs down to 4 day weeks?
I'm going to have to go thumbs down.
Thumbs down. Tell us
why. Because the kids need it. But what I will say is that they could shorten it to an eight hour work week. Because we want to try to get away from teaching our children about the work ethic.
Mm-hmm.
And children have to have a work ethic. In this country, if you don't learn the work ethic, you understand what I'm saying? If everything is easy for you, where you can get away with 4 days or a 6 hour work day, and I'm quite sure that there's some people out there would enjoy that, so they wouldn't have to, mainly corporate America and stuff, so that they wouldn't have to pay overtime and 4 hour work weeks. Well, it's basically based on your benefits.
Yep.
So we can't let children get.
They need to learn the grit.
They need to learn. They need to learn that your hours, basic work hours, 4 hours a week, and that pays for your Social Security. And it pays for grandma's Social Security.
That's right. Don't forget about grandma.
When we send in our kids to school, they need to learn at least an 8 hour work week. And I'm okay. That's just the way I see it. And
thank you, Wayne. Thank you very much.
No, I think that's a great perspective, yep, right? Start training them from, that's how school was presented to us, right? It was, mom and dad went to work during the day. Our work was school.
There you go.
And we better perform well.
Up next, we have Kathy. How are you today, Kathy?
Great.
Great. Thanks for calling in. Thumbs up, thumbs down to a 4-day week.
Thumbs down at the moment, just because we have relatives in the child care industry and they'd lose a whole 20% of their income.
Oh, that's actually a really good perspective, not necessarily from the kids needing the additional.
Yeah, not to mention that, you know, a lot of parents, there's best parents working, and I'm sure they don't get off on Friday.
So you're saying if it was 4 days that child care would suffer as well? You don't look at it as they would get more business?
As an opportunity to work more. No, because so many of them are strictly after school programs.
Ah, gotcha. Okay. Yep, so then the after school programs.
And it's very much a cultural thing to Kathy's point, right?
Just maybe start phasing it in, like getting out at noon on Friday to actually get there. But at the moment, the way that our economy and culture set up, it couldn't happen overnight.
No, certainly, like any big change, right? We know it certainly couldn't happen overnight. Kathy, thank you for calling in for that interesting perspective. We appreciate it.
No problem. Yep. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Bye.
Take care. So it's kind of 50-50, huh? So,
yeah,
more people thumbs down, actually.
Where are you ending up, Mandy?
Where am I ending up?
I want to know.
I am, if it's done correctly, I don't mind. I don't necessarily think it's done about the days. So if they're being innovative and making sure that all the needs are taken care of and the kids are good and it's going to somehow result in better outcomes, why not?
But I love that somehow, right? Yeah. That qualifier. Somehow.
That's what they're doing. But if they're just shortening, the school week to save dollars on bus routes, I mean, whatever is the best interest of the children is what I support. What about you?
Well, as a social worker, I expected you to say something about have that day for rest and reflection and self-care.
But I'm over that.
I don't know. No. Oh, says the social worker. Great. Thanks, Mandy. But I do think our next guest will actually provide, could possibly speak to that.
I think so. So up next, we have Ann Sung, Vice President and Chief Strategy Officer with Project Grad Houston and also Houston ISD, Houston Independent School District, Board of Education, Trustee District 7. How are you doing today, Ann?
I'm doing great.
Great.
How are you?
Wonderful.
Great. Thank you
so
much,
Ann. Are you ready for school? I hope so.
Yeah, ready.
Yay. And go.
Go. School.
So I know that you know, it's been a nice summer for many people, and then it's like rush, 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 and let's get back to the routine and the grind. And, you know, from Project Grad Houston and also speaking as a board trustee for HISD, what kind of back-to-school tips do you have for parents?
Well, you know, we're a week off from the start of school, as Houston ISD, and some school districts have already started.
That's right.
And, you know, it's about getting back into the routine. You know, the one of the most important things for our children's success is just showing up. And so parents can really help by making sure they set that expectation with their children that we're going to get to school and get to school on time every single day and be there.
I love that you said not just get to school, but get to school on time, and that you specified every single day. That's not something we just do on Mondays or just do on Fridays, but that's something that being there and being present is so important for kids.
And absolutely.
And there are a lot of parents out there who can get their kids, right? And then they don't know what to do after that. So if their child is struggling or if they're just anxious, you might have a little kindergartner. Congratulations, your baby's going to the big kids school. Or it could be that fifth grader. What are the best ways or some tips that you can encourage parents to be engaged in a child's education?
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, it's when parents start bringing their kids to school, you know it's important to go to those meetings. When I go to the school meetings with pre-K parents, they're packed. right? Everybody knows that you got to show up for those meetings, you know, listen to what your teachers have to say about your child. But that's important all along, you know, for your kindergarten, your first grader, your fifth grader, but even high school students. So
that's when you get the information,
with a
right?
Child's teachers can be at those open houses. But even if you can't make the open house that's scheduled at the school, I encourage parents to call in to their school, find another time to meet with their teachers, because that relationship is so important. Parents learn so much from talking with their teachers and learning how they can support their child. And like I said, that's important all the way up through high school.
Well, and I think, too, getting the information is so key. What you just said, I think about, I have a friend whose daughter is a tween, and I talked to her this weekend, and I asked, you know, well, how was school? How, you know, how's your first week back? And I was getting responses like, fine and good. And, you know, I was like, well, what are you going to be learning in science this year? What are you going to be reading? And she just didn't have, she wasn't willing to quite share that information. So as parents, making sure that we're getting that information firsthand, I think is always really important.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we forget that a lot of times our older children still may need some support in how they structure their time. Not that parents are going to be doing homework for them, but it's important for parents to know what are the expectations.
Well, that's right. And I think parents...
And one trick is to, you know, ask teachers what's going well. You know, we parents expect to hear from teachers when things are going wrong at school, but it's also really not... What's going well, and celebrate that with your child. It can be a way to build a connection for that child who doesn't seem to have much to share up front.
That's great. And hopefully they would be willing to, you know, once you kind of open that perspective, it allows both a kid, a child, a student, and a teacher to be able to elaborate quite a bit.
Now, I can't lie. My biggest fear, and I preach this all the time, is that a parent is the child's first teacher. Right. And so
absolutely.
This is the foundation, and I feel like I'm doing it now. I have a fear that there's going to be a point in time where math and maybe even science is something that I'm learning from them.
Maybe
you know,
a little
bit. Like, how am I going to be able to support? So that's Mandy's example. I know that I'm not alone, right? And it might be parents
absolutely.
For other issues. What can you suggest to parents who want to help and don't quite know how?
Yeah. So, you know, parents are absolutely a child's first teacher. And you know, I think the important thing is that they care and they take an interest in their child's education. That's the most important thing. And being there to set that priority is important, whether or not you can help your child with Algebra 2 homework or not. And it turns out that there are lots of great resources these days that parents can tap into. So even if you yourself might not remember, you know, what de Moivre's theorem is, there are resources online now. Khan Academy accesses through resources through the Houston Public Library, and HISD has a learning link now, so that just using your student ID as an HISD student, you can access all the Houston Public Library resources.
Oh, wow,
that's
a good resource.
You can get access to tutorials for free, so that there will be somebody at the other end of the line who does remember Algebra 2 a little bit better.
Thankfully. Those people exist to help our kids.
Yep, it's true. So we're talking about the public education system, I understand. But then we want every child to be college or career ready. Do you have any suggestions of when we should start having those conversations with our children and students in regards to what does your path look like and next steps after high school?
It's really never too early to start talking to children about college, and more, that's for every child to be start thinking that education doesn't end with high school, that some training beyond high school is going to be needed for jobs these days. So, you know, in elementary school, it's a good time to start letting kids know that after school comes college, and that's exciting. And to start talking about what are the colleges, you know, here in Houston, you know, and around the country, and even overseas. And then even starting in middle school, I encourage parents to check out online resources Houston ISD has Naviance. Most school districts will have some similar tool, and that's free. If you have an HISD ID, you can go online, you can take career inventory, start to explore. There's great kid-friendly videos out there to help them understand careers that didn't exist when you and I were graduating from college.
That's absolutely right.
And to start researching colleges.
Well, I love to hear something like a kindergartner talk about where they're going to college. There's just nothing better than that in my world. But you hear the music, and that means we are wrapping up, but we have just enough time to hit you with our final four questions. And this gives all of our listeners just the opportunity to get to know you a little bit better. So with that, Anne, can you tell us your favorite toy to play with when you were a child?
I love Legos.
Yeah.
I love it. A classic.
What did you want to be when you were growing up?
Oh, an astronaut.
Oh, nice. I like how you said that without hesitation, an astronaut.
Lego-building astronaut.
Yeah. Perfect. Perfect combo. And what about your favorite book to read as a child?
Watership Down.
Oh, that was a classic. I read that and didn't read that until high school. Oh, and based on the look on Mandy's face, I don't know that she ever
great.
Read
it. Sounds great. It's on my list. Thank you for calling me out there.
Sure.
And what was your final question? What was your favorite movie when you were a kid?
It's a tough
one. What comes to mind is Princess Bride, which should have been my favorite movie when I was a kid, but I didn't watch it until I was a teenager.
Well, that's okay. That's a great movie.
I was going to say, also a classic. So
we've been talking with Anne Sung, who is Vice President and Chief Strategy Officer for Project Grad Houston, and also the School Board Trustee District 7 for Houston Independent School District. Thank you so much for what you do for our community, and we greatly appreciate all the support that you give to the Houston children. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Absolutely. All right. Well, I didn't do that.
You didn't.
I didn't touch a button.
That was a perfect way for us to go out this afternoon, Mandy. It's been a great time being here with you today.
Thank you. It has been so much fun. And I want to wish all the children, if you're listening, good luck in the 2018-2019 school year.
It's going to be a good one.
Congratulations, parents. You made it through the summer.
That's right.
Ready to do the happy dance. And we're going to be talking to you next week. For more facts and information on children, visit us at childrenatrisk.org. Follow us on Twitter and listen in every Monday morning for our commentary of activism and children during the KPFT Morning News Hour at 8 a.m. If you'd like to learn more about Children at Risk, please email us at radio@childrenatrisk.org. Thank you to our engineer, Don. Thank you, Laura. And take care. And you're listening to Growing Up in America, Pacifica Radio.